All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number as Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, we're now $30 trillion in debt. And during the wars and the response to 9/11, we spent $5.8 trillion in our excursions. And I don't think people were at all concerned about the fact that we spent $5.8 trillion in Iraq and Afghanistan. Probably didn't, and other excursions that we're involved in, that people probably say, sure, that's the right thing to do. We did the right thing. The money was well spent. No problem. But now, you know, we're talking about Biden. If what there he is asking for goes through, it'll be over $50 billion for Ukraine. And that's just now. Because everything points to this dragging out and that this is going to continue. You know, it's not just going to end after we invest the amount of money that we're going to invest this time around. We're going to continue to feed Ukraine until, I guess, there's some kind of end. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, war is an open checkbook, apparently. When we get involved
in military matters. Yeah, but we're not at war with them.
Well, I know. When we get involved in military matters, in this case, the journalists wrote about how it was that Russia was accusing us of having a proxy war. They used the word accuse. This is clearly a proxy war. We're clearly opening our checkbook. People are talking about it. We win. You know, win. We win this. You know, we aren't there except we're writing lots of checks and sending lots of money. The estimate for the rebuilding of Ukraine, were Ukraine to win this thing and then need to be rebuilt by the people who are supporting it, the current estimate for rebuilding it is $85 billion, and it's going up remarkably, and I'm sure that's an underestimate. So when you look at the dollars that get spent when we get involved in our military activities, whether they be direct wars or proxy wars, we just open our checkbook and write it. And the Congress doesn't seem to debate it anywhere near the same level of criticism and critical thinking as they would child daycare or the things that we want to enact for the benefit of the American people. So it's really a travesty, I think. It's a travesty because it's a war. It's a travesty because I think we got there without having a fundamental strategic thinking that started this. Once we walked down this path, I think I talked about it in one of the earlier shows, you know, we don't know how our governments decide who our enemies are. And then when we decide who our enemies are, they immediately become our enemy and we their enemy. And then the conduct between those parties becomes very different. And we don't know the extent to which our conduct has precipitated conduct by Russia, which has precipitated a situation that now seems to involve our involvement and Russia's involvement in a path that is going to be very hard to stop and very hard to reverse. Once you get going in something like this, you know, the notion that for instance, Putin is talking about using nuclear weaponry, and we talk about how it is that we shouldn't kowtow and bow to someone's threats, and so we need to maybe rattle our swords louder than Mr. Putin does. Well, now, just look where we are. We've gotten ourselves into this contest in a place that's in a geopolitical place that we have little knowledge of and which is highly complicated. We're now reading about Moldova, Nistria. We're reading about the Kaliningrad and the corridor that runs to Kaliningrad, which is runs through Poland and Lithuania to get there from Belarus. Kaliningrad is part of Russia. Kaliningrad has some of a major Baltic seaport and naval base for Russia. Russia needs to and wants to have access to that land. It's like you bought, if you bought a property that was in the middle of a farm field, you in Wisconsin law, real estate law, you'd have a right of access to that farmland over, you'd have an easement to get there. Well, that's essentially what Russia has in this corridor, the Suwalki corridor that runs through there to Kaliningrad. This is something that might come into play now and will come into play on turf that belongs to Poland and Lithuania, which are part of NATO. Moldova was carved out of Romania. Moldova has Nistria, which is filled with Russian-speaking people. We're now having Moldova attacked. So there's a can of worms that's been opened, and how was it opened? Well, I think that our American foreign policy played a role in it, but now it's almost too late to call a halt to it. At least that's the way our policymakers are looking at it. Hopefully we'll continue to use constraint, but mark my words, these places that we've never heard of, Moldova, Kaliningrad, the Suwalki corridor, and Nistria, 3 weeks from now, more Americans are going to know what I'm talking about when I use those terms.
You know, Sandy, President Biden, early on in this, was reluctant to really get involved or engage. He's been pushed into this.
Well, that's the problem. The talk becomes very machismo, right? We're not going to kowtow. We got to rattle our sword louder. Right. We've got to do what it takes to win this. We got to keep giving. And currently what we have going is a proxy war in which the fatalities are all being experienced by the participants in the war, which are Ukrainians and Russians. And the likelihood, the continued likelihood of this, even amongst the observers, is that ultimately Ukraine will get partitioned, that the Donbas region is likely to succumb to being Russian, to the fait accompli that probably was accomplished at the time of the Crimea annexation is going to be recognized. So we've got the fait accompli of the Crimea. There was this fait accompli of the Donbas and the autonomy that was set up in the treaty of 2014, the Budapest Treaty. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of damage done to Ukraine, its infrastructure, and to its people. And then the question is, what is the outcome?
You know, Sandy, more and more you're hearing Americans, and I don't mean those, you know, talking heads, but average Americans who have said, yes, let's move forward. Let's do this. Let's bail Ukraine out, and let's do whatever it is we have to do. Cavalierly making statements, not knowing, as you stated, just how complex and complicated this is. And they really don't care about right now whether it's complicated or complex. They see that, you know, these people are at war and their hearts bleed because they say, hey, they look just like us. You know, that could very easily be my auntie or in some instances, they are interconnected because, you know, they are those kinds of people. Those are their brothers and sisters. And so it's easy to say, let's go ahead and move forward. We just talked about that $5.8 trillion that was spent. And what did we really get out of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? I mean, for the $5.8 trillion, nobody can tell me what we got out of that.
No, I mean, we got a bunch of scars. And, you know, it wasn't good. We lost a bunch of people. We lost a lot of treasure. We spent money that could have been spent on other things. We spent money we didn't have. We had deficits the whole time. So we weren't financing this war. We were saddling our children and grandchildren with the deficit.
And yet we also, for the most part, all supported it.
Well, that's because I think instead of doing critical thinking when it comes to foreign policy and being given the facts we could possibly use to become involved with analyzing foreign policy, we're all just obedient. We're obediently patriotic, and we get told by our government essentially what kind of obedience we need to carry out in order to be patriots. And we learn that during the flyovers of the NFL games and other times we have to do the stand up for the Star Spangled Banner and the cover our hearts for the Pledge of Allegiance, and there's a bunch of steps we go through, but ultimately it's to ask us to be absolutely obedient about being in support of whatever it is we do with our military or our military might.
But you know, Sandy, that's okay, and you know, that was all right in the other skirmishes that we were involved in. But you look at the end of this and what could possibly occur, and this does not require that, as you said, that we just sit down and be quiet and just nod our heads like bobbleheads to what's taking place. Because at the end of this is conversations, and not just by, you know, Putin, but many in our at the United States senators, Joint Chiefs of Staff. These people are all talking about what could be at the end of this.
Well, the problem is that we didn't do an analysis in terms of figuring out how we embarked on this path. We didn't go through a geopolitical analysis that was a sort of a critical and fundamental strategic analysis on our part. We seem to have stumbled into this based on various parts of the government thinking that this was a good idea. But this is geopolitically a very complicated region. The geopolitics of this part of Eurasia, of the Ukrainian part that is surrounded by Romania, Moldova, Dnistria, that has this Kaliningrad part of Russia that is disconnected from Russia, that is disconnected through a corridor that runs through Lithuania and Poland. All of that are factual details that, when you look at it carefully, you can realize how it is that for Russia, this is a very important gain, okay? And for the United States, it's only important because it's important to Russia.
Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Sandy Williams is here. You can join us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number as Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, before we went to break, we were talking about what's coming up at almost a critical juncture in this war between Ukraine and Russia and America. And you were saying before we went to break about the fact that the American people really aren't astute.
Well, I don't think we're not astute. I don't think we're asked to get into the discussion, and we're not given the facts we would need to carry out an astute analysis of it. You know, the last time we were asked to do any kind of analysis was the invasion of Iraq, when there were public hearings. Colin Powell was called forward to testify, and the American public was supposedly given the information it needed.
I remember watching that.
That we had to go there because of the weapons of mass destruction that were going to be in Saddam Hussein's hands. That maybe he was developing a nuclear weapon. Oh man!
And white cake and
oh yeah, we had to move in for all those reasons, which turned out not to be the case. You know, why did we stay in Afghanistan for so long? There was never that kind of discussion. And there was never that kind of discussion with respect to Ukraine as to why it was, what the strategic American interests were in Ukraine, or to understand what it was Russia saw as its strategic interests, whether NATO was something that was a realistic possibility for Ukraine, or was it really just eyewash and big talk? Because everyone who was in the know about it understood that even the United States wasn't going to be that enthusiastic about Ukraine coming into NATO, and that it was all talk and sword rattling. And it was that until the strategic charter agreement in November, I think it was November 14th, and that apparently Biden signed with Ukraine, that was going to be an invitation from the U.S. to enter NATO, or at least a statement that America would welcome that, which didn't mean they were going to get in either, but it certainly increased the likelihood, and probably had a great deal to do with Putin's thinking about whether he needed to invade Ukraine sooner rather than later, or because he was not achieving his diplomatic the outcome that he wanted diplomatically. The reason he wasn't achieving it diplomatically is that we were supporting Ukraine, giving them the muscle to stand up in a way that maybe wasn't geopolitically normal for a country in that region. There was a confederation that was set up, a federation of countries that was essentially similar to the EU that was set up out of 12 of the 15 republics that left the USSR, and they joined together in a league. The only three that didn't join were Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, and they joined NATO. But and that was also a problem. And physically, that's now a problem with respect to this place that I was describing, Kaliningrad, which is strategically important to Russia.
So
we've got all of these strategic issues, and we have sort of played with Ukraine without ever having a public discussion as to whether or not Ukraine was fundamentally strategically important to us in anything like the same manner that it is fundamentally and strategically important to Russia.
So I was watching one of the shows on yesterday, and I heard it mentioned that the reason somebody asked the exact same question, well, this is not strategic to our nation and important to our nation. Why are we there? And the response from one of the from the guy who's I forget who he was, but he's a very high ranking guy, and his response was, if we don't stop Russia now, we may be at war with them after they invade one of taking for granted to assume that Russia is going to eventually invade, one of.
Well, I mean, I think the reason, if you get behind it, I think the reason that Russia invaded Ukraine was that they were not going to be happy with having Ukraine be part of NATO and therefore have issues associated with their access to the Black Sea and also their strategic gas pipelines that flow under Ukraine. And they were interested in having a Eurasian continent that was altogether friendly to one another and to Russia, and so now they have a problem with Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and this Kaliningrad island that exists there, and so we've set the table for Russia to feel threatened by a circumstance which they wouldn't have felt threatened by if those countries had, if we had left them to their own devices. Now, should we leave countries to their own devices? As I said earlier, I think this whole principle of hegemony and this power, this geopolitical power that large, powerful countries have over their neighbors has a lack of morality to it. But America exercises its hegemony regularly over all of its neighbors and, in fact, over countries that bound us across oceans. And so we have to recognize that there is that pragmatic reality that exists for others as well. It clearly exists for China, and it clearly exists for Russia. And so when we decide to ignore the hegemony of a country like Russia by carrying out this flirtation with Ukraine, which clearly is in Russia's front, it's in their front yard.
So, but is it safe to assume, our nation to assume, that if we don't stop Russia now, they're going to be going into the NATO countries? I mean, at this risk, but
I think the reason that Russia invaded, I think the more likely answer is that the reason Russia invaded Ukraine is because it isn't in NATO and
right.
wasn't yet in NATO, and they are going to be exceedingly unlikely to invade a country that would involve NATO. So I think this whole question of what happens with Kaliningrad and how do they solidify the corridor to Kaliningrad without stepping into a NATO country with their troops is much more complicated for them. And I suspect that they're going to be interested in negotiating that. Now, will we be able to carry out any form of negotiation with Russia going forward after this? Well, it's certainly going to be difficult now with the invasion and with the hardening of the positions between the countries. Should we undoubtedly have considered diplomatically solving all of these problems? Undoubtedly.
So the new Cold War is underway.
Well, we've certainly got a, we certainly have something like a Cold War initiated now. We certainly have something like a partitioning of the world started now. And I just think that the United States needs to much more carefully evaluate its strategic interests in the world before we do things which have echo and reverberating seismic effects. Because I think anybody who's a student of this would have to say that Russia was reacting to the United States and to NATO in the conduct, in what has occurred here. You know, we can't necessarily say that we're happy for Georgia and the fact that Georgia was brought to heel by Russia, or that Belarus is such a devoted ally to Russia, but the Belarusians and the Georgians aren't necessarily terribly unhappy by the outcome of this, and maybe the United States should be okay with the, those outcomes.
So we're at the center of this, and the American people should be asking our government how we got to the center of this, right? That's what you're saying.
Yes, I think we're going to have to analyze how we got here in order to modify the path that we're on, which currently involves a wide-open checkbook and a view that we're now involved with an existential kind of a conflict with Russia. What this general, whoever this high-ranking person was saying, was essentially, hey, this is existential, this Ukrainian thing.
Right.
Because if we weren't defending them there, we'll end up having to defend them in NATO.
And we don't need to be talking about this 20 years from now. We need to be talking about it now.
Yes.
Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
John, yo.
Wait a minute. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show, as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And so, Sandy, what made me really want to talk about Ukraine is I watched
Meet the Press.
A well-known and well-respected Senator Menendez speaking yesterday on the risk of Putin using nuclear weapons increases the more Ukraine succeeds. And yet he's saying we have to make sure that Ukraine succeeds. And I don't know if he's not comprehending what it is he's saying, or if we, the American people, yeah, we want to see Ukraine succeed, but if at the end of that, it means they've been able to stop Russia, and Russia then kind of licks his wounds and goes back home, and nothing else happens after that, that's not going to be the outcome, Sandy, with if that happens. I mean, I don't know. I'm no specialist, but I do believe that Putin is the kind of person who is not going to accept the fact that what he attempted to do was stopped by, you know, NATO and the United States government, and really the United States and NATO, not NATO and the United States.
Yes. I mean, there's no question the United States is the ringleader of NATO, right?
Right.
And that's the way I think it's viewed by everyone, and certainly viewed that way by Russia. No, I mean, I think most observers believe that Putin and Russia are going to do what it takes to accomplish their objective. And the more they are thwarted militarily under the tactics and with the equipment that they're currently using, the more likely it is that they will up the ante with respect to the nature of the weaponry that they apply strategically in order to accomplish the objective. And so, yes, I think Menendez is probably right to the extent that I think he's right, that the more successful we make the Ukraine in their ability to the Ukrainians to defend themselves, the more likely it is that Russia will use more and more destructive kinds of weaponry, whether it be Carpen bombing, whether it be hypersonic kind of bombs that they can drop, whether it be these hypersonic cruise missiles. I mean, whether they get all the way to nuclear is a question, and there would be tactical nuclear. I don't think anyone's thinking that they're going to be dropping nuclear bombs. I think it's much more that it would be nuclear artillery and that kind of thing. But it makes it more likely that much more dangerous kinds of weaponry would be used by Russia. So, again, this takes me into this discussion of once we get into this concept that we're in it to the end, essentially, that we're going to provide Ukraine what it needs, we've started on a path that we can't stop unless we get back to the beginning of the path and to figure out why we got on that path and whether we should be on that path or whether there's some other reasoning. And to some extent, it gets very late in the game to do that. It's very hard for a country to say, well, you know what, we're going to go back and reevaluate what the hell we've been doing here to see if we started out correctly. And so I would take as a low likelihood the notion that the United States can actually rethink its path. But we're on a dangerous path. And the notion that it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, the more we talk about things like weakening Russia, and having that be one of our objectives, then Russia says, well, why are you trying to weaken us? Are you trying to weaken us so that you can block our path to Kaliningrad? Why are you doing this? And maybe we need to take measures to make sure that we can secure the things that we think are strategically important.
You know, Sandy, I know I'm naive, but I thought the Joint Chiefs make recommendations.
The Joint Chiefs make recommendations about how to do things militarily.
Oh,
okay. So they're the military advisors, and they would tell the president what's militarily possible, and they might be giving advice now on what kind of military weapons should be given. But
not whether or not we should be engaged.
Whether or not we should be engaged is advice that comes from the State Department. It probably comes from the Central Intelligence Agency. It would come from parts of the government that don't have open discussions with the people of the United States. In fact, the briefings that were given to Congress about this were undoubtedly given in secret briefings. So does the United States understand? Do the people of the United States understand why? Do the politicians even understand why? Or is it really this kind of shadow government that is these institutions that seem to guide our foreign policies, and they have so much to do with this, and that's where I see the American public being led down a path that is a difficult one.
So here's what the American people need to understand. I was reading something the other day, Sandy, that said that the bomb shelters,
yeah,
in Europe, they're selling these new bomb shelters like candy, because the people in Europe are thinking, hey, this could, and understanding why they've been to the brink several times.
Well, there's a run on this iodine medication that's necessary to resist radioactive fallout. There's all kinds of fear ongoing about whether or not nuclear can happen. And, you know,
but not in our country. It's almost like we're ignoring all of this.
Well, you know, this is the first time, and I don't think this is what people need to understand. This is really the first time that the Americans and Russians have been almost looking down guns at one another, right? We are, the Russians are in a war, and we are actively throwing weaponry into it. We were reluctant to do that very much in Afghanistan. We ultimately did it when Russia was in Afghanistan. There was a movie made about the congressman, I think it was Joe Wilson, who kind of secretly got a whole bunch of weapons in the hands of the Mujahideen, actually Osama bin Laden, to resist the Russians. But we were very reluctant to get very heavily involved with arming an army or a people against the Russian army. And now we are doing it enthusiastically.
Yeah, if the shoe was on the other foot and Russia was interfering, which they were, I mean, in Afghanistan and
Well, we're Russia,
we've always been on the other side of these skirmishes.
Well, we've typically been on the other side of the supply of weaponry, okay? So
right.
Typically when we've been at war with someone, it's somebody who is a weapons client of Russia, so they buy their weaponry from Russia. So I think our view is that we can, with relative impunity, continue to be the arms provider to someone like Ukraine, and that's kind of been accepted in the general world.
And in this instance, we're not selling weapons, we're giving weapons. And I think there's a little difference. I think Russia might be able to understand it.
Well, I just think that the question really is that in this particular circumstance, we're involved with something that Russia has declared to be a matter of vital national interest. And so we're in the position of trying to thwart that. And the dynamics are kind of potentially the possibility is that they will get away from us.
You know, but here we are. If somebody says to me directly, hey, you're interfering, right? I'm in a fight, and it's just, you know, my brother and I. And here you, in simplest terms, have jumped into this fight. And even though, you know, I hear people constantly say, Earl, what are you talking about? We don't have any boots underground. I said, boots underground is not the issue. Boots underground would not cause as much damage as the weaponry that we've sent into.
Well, yeah, I mean, boots on the ground and weaponry, would be a significant upgrade to the Ukrainian defense if they were going to be supplemented in manpower by third party countries, but. I think the thing that we're ignoring here is that there has been this long-term historic recognition after the Potsdam breakdown of the country, the Warsaw Pact countries, that there has been a long-standing recognition of the geopolitics of Eurasia, which we started to ignore beginning in about 2004 to 2008. And since then, we've created quite a confrontational circumstance with the Russian Federation, and you know, it's been coming to a head, it's been brewing, and so, you know, should this have been handled diplomatically in a different fashion? I would assert yes, it should have been.
You know, Sandy, one of the things that we would be remiss if we didn't talk about is the famine that's coming. The longer this goes on, the more likely it is that there's going to be major famine.
Yes.
Throughout the world.
Yeah.
And the world gets dragged into this. And so I don't think we as the American people really see the whole picture.
Well, the collateral damage here is going to be substantial. The collateral world damage in terms of damage to economies, damage to the supply chain of food, damage to individual people around, you know, particularly those who are at the brink or at the edge of famine all the time, people to whom wheat is of vital importance. There's just going to be a lot of collateral damage from this, and we have to weigh, we should have weighed, what it was that was the strategic interest of Europe and the United States in the circumstances associated with this part of Eurasia, the particularly Ukraine, and why were we carrying out this flirtation with Ukraine, which put them in the position of being able to exercise a great deal of disdain for what other countries in that area have not been able to do vis-a-vis Russia.
You know, Sandy, this article is in Politico. It says, get ready for hail. UN food chief warns amid Ukraine shockwaves. And he talks about the long-term suffering that even if this was to end today, people are going to be suffering all over the world. And I still don't think that, again, we can see what is coming. You've been warning of it, and now the UN is clearly letting, the longer this goes, the more damaging this is going to be to the entire globe. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Hey. All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number as Mondays. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, I was reading this because I don't know how we can, you know, you talked about 40% of the globe.
No, I think 40% of Africa. Africa gets 40% of its wheat
from Ukraine.
From Ukraine and Russia. And so, you know, Africa's a continent that teeters on the brink, North Africa particularly, teeters on the brink of famine all the time. This is almost half, and wheat is such an important part of the nutrient food chain for that kind of a population, that it's going to be a disaster.
So Ukraine, as it states here, is not going to be able to, they're in the middle of a war. They're not going to be able to grow crops in the middle of a war. The other part of it is it talked about, Sandy, the refugees that are going to be at the doorstep of Europe. And you say what to that? Because eventually they're going to be here.
Well, sure. I mean, I just think that people don't realize all of the collateral damage that's done by war, particularly war in important parts of the world, that are highly interrelated with other parts of the world. I mean, Iraq had an influence on oil and the oil effect, but otherwise not so much. Afghanistan is not intrinsically involved with many kinds of trade in the world trade, but Russia and Ukraine are seriously involved in the food business and in the commodities business generally. I think that same thing you were reading talked about fertilizer, and phosphate fertilizer is a huge source of export from Russia. And fertilizer is very basic to agriculture and to the food chain around the world. So there's just all kinds of collateral impacts that are caused by this kind of a huge upset.
Yeah, well, they're projecting famine.
Yeah. And obviously famine has a huge effect on refugee flow, and Europe has already suffered the impact of refugees coming from the Mideast in particular and North Africa, and now it's clearly going to happen again. And so that's going to be very disruptive, socially disruptive. It has been one of the contributors to social disruption and the movement to the right of countries in Europe. Much of the movement to the right in Europe was caused by the reaction to refugees and the refugee problems.
So whether this ends up in a real shooting world war, it is going to be a world consequences. Global consequences.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's going to be economic and financial consequences. It appears from this information that there's very likely to be actual consequences associated with the welfare of people in terms of having enough to eat. And so, you know, when we get involved in something like we have gotten involved in here, we should understand how very, very serious it is and that it's not something that we should play with. And I would assert that much of our policies associated with Ukraine have been us toying with something rather than actually understanding the whole situation and figuring out what diplomatically is the appropriate reaction.
You know, Sandy, I get it, if you really give this some thought, and if you know, I'm going to be honest with you, there's no question if I wasn't on the radio right now, I wouldn't be spending as much time as I'm spending in following this.
Right.
But because I am spending that time, we're trying to bring this message to people. This is a dangerous, dangerous time. I mean, it's not Iraq. It's not Afghanistan. It's none of those things. And it is safe to say probably one of the most dangerous times since World War II, right?
Yes, the danger is there, and it is undoubtedly the most dangerous time we've had since World War II. And I suppose it feels particularly dangerous.
And we're not even involved in it.
Well, it feels particularly dangerous because it's people like us who are having this war. I suspect that in the Mideast, they would have said they were experiencing more dangerous times some while ago.
Right.
So, you know, it's a little bit as whose ox is being gored. But right now, our ox is being gored sociologically, politically, geopolitically. And to me, I just think that this is the result of American foreign policy and American politics being unable to deal with nuances, the nuances of geopolitical realities and geopolitical diplomacy. And as I've said on a couple of shows before, I don't think there's a great deal of morality that's involved with the particular choices we make geopolitically, but there's a great deal of involved pragmatically. And pragmatically, if we had looked at this, we would have known that we were playing with dynamite, playing with literal dynamite in terms of world welfare, as well as local welfare in Ukraine, as well as the welfare of the Eurasian continent and the continent of Asia. We have been playing with dynamite ever since we started playing with the situation in Ukraine and the situation in the old USSR.
You know, Sandy, as a young man, I was always hearing about the greatest generation. And many of those people are gone now in this country who made sacrifices, who really knew that the sacrifices had to be. Most of the Americans today don't know anything at all about sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
But these other folk all over the world know what sacrifice is. And so I'm just wondering how we're going to respond. When there comes a point in this, we haven't exactly gotten there yet. I mean, we're still paying for the gas prices, the inflation, and we're crying, right? I mean, we're really letting people know that this is starting to impact and affect us. You ain't seen nothing yet, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at how this is affecting people in Europe, okay, they're experiencing a much more direct level of inflation and potential deprivation. If you look at how it's affecting people in Russia, of course, it's like, you know, it's way, way different, right? Their level of hardship and the level of sacrifice they're being called upon to make is very much greater than what we're dealing with. And, you know, we're looking at that as maybe a hopeful sign that they'll change their administration. You know, the polling that's been done in Russia suggests that it's hardening the view of the Russian public in support of what's going on in Ukraine. They're looking at all of this through the other end, through the lens at the other end of the telescope, okay? And that's where I think we've had trouble and where we've run amok here is we've not looked at this in terms of the geopolitical realities. And I think that it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we had let this play out diplomatically in a way that was going to be much more normal geopolitically for that region, instead of inserting NATO and American views into the process, in particular of the negotiations ongoing between Russia and Ukraine, it could have been a whole different outcome that would not have involved arms.
You know, Sandy, it's a sobering time. And the more I look at this and read about it, yeah, it's a sobering time that's coming. And not just because the interest rates or inflation, but the fact that we are really going to be tested like many of us have never been tested in our lifetimes. It's coming.
Well, it could well be coming, but I think I would step back a little bit and say I think the most likely impact in the United States will be the financial impact of a recession that's quite likely to occur sometime in the next while. I think that this whole international problem, I pray and hope that it will pass without having it become the dire consequence that we're now talking about.
All right. We got to get out of here. Thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Sandy. Thank you, Sam. You've been tuned into Earl Ingram Show. See you later.